quantos sonhos já destruí e deixei escapar das mãos. Se o futuro assim permitir, não pretendo viver em vão. Meu amor, não estamos sós, tem um mundo a esperar por nós. No infinito do céu azul, pode ter vida em Marte, então vem, me dá a sua língua. Então vem, eu quero abraçar você. Seu poder vem do sol, minha medida. Então vem, vamos viver a vida. Então vem, senão eu vou perder quem sou.
Hi, this is Landon Godfrey, and you are listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5 North Asheville, North Carolina. Not North Asheville, but all of Asheville.
Our massive signal.
And I am very pleased to have been invited to host the show today, and I am here with three people. Our regular Wordplay host, Jeff Davis.
Hello, Landon.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
And then we have two guests today, Stephen Samuels, who apparently calls himself a writer, no matter what he does. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Stephen has an extensive career in theater and publishing, including very famously his lifelong association with Charles Ludlam and the Ridiculous Theatrical Company. And he currently teaches creative writing at Warren Wilson College. And he also teaches in the Great Smokies Writing Program. So we're very glad to have him here with us today. And we also have Gary Hawkins here today.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I will confess right at the top of the show that Gary is my poet husband.
Oh, no!
I know. He's also a scholar, and he writes on modern and contemporary American poetry from Dickinson to Creeley. And Gary is also the director of the undergraduate writing program at Warren Wilson College. I'm very pleased to be here with all of you.
It's good to be here.
When I was thinking about a topic for the show today, or just doing the show today, I thought a topic might be nice. And I was thinking, because of where we are doing the show in Asheville, North Carolina, and my kind of peripatetic gallivanting across the United States from city to city, and now living in the woods, that nature poetry might be a good topic for today's conversation, especially since I come to this topic with a bit of a kind of cranky attitude.
Nature?
And when I hear that we're going to talk about nature poetry, even as I suggest it, I feel chagrin. And so I wondered why that might be. And I invited I'm here with varying degrees of crankiness represented by these three co-poets, and so I was very interested in why one might have a cranky attitude towards this, because there are some assumptions about nature poetry that are definitely not unaddressed, but they aren't as addressed, they aren't as frequently addressed as perhaps I myself would like. So one of the things that I was thinking about was that when the rigor of looking at the world is absent, when looking at it with a very discerning eye is absent, then sentimentality is present. And that may or may not be the experience of the people in this room with me, but that is certainly something that I've experienced. And so I often, just as a human being and a poet, feel kind of excluded from the conversation, as if I'm not worthy of it, because I'm not worthy of the sentimental.
You're worthy of it, you just don't suffer from it.
That's right. That's right. And that somehow I'm coming to the world as a cynic, which isn't accurate at all, but that my lack of desire for sentimental reassurance puts me somewhere in the mode of the city rather than the country. And that I saw some dichotomies that may or may not be accurate, but that seem to be prevalent. And I wanted to start, before we have a conversation, with two poems that I think frame this way, this kind of divisive version of nature poetry in its most simplistic, city bad, nature good, as if those things weren't the same. But that's one of the things that I'd like to talk with you about today. So I wanted to read a poem by Frank O'Hara, which hopefully is not too famous for you to listen to again, called The Day Lady Died. It is 12:20 in New York, a Friday, 3 days after Bastille Day. Yes, it is 1959, and I go get a shoe shine because I will get off the 419 in East Hampton at 7:15 and then go straight to dinner, and I don't know the people who will feed me. I walk up the muggy street, beginning to sun, and have a hamburger and a malted and buy an ugly New World writing to see what the poets in Ghana are doing these days. I go on to the bank, and Miss Stillwagon, first name Linda, I once heard, doesn't even look up at my look up my balance for once in her life, and in the Golden Griffin I get a little Verlaine for Patsy with drawings by Bernard, although I do think of Hesiod translated by Richard Lattimore, or Brendan Behan's new play, or Le Balcon, or Les Nègres of Genet, but I don't. I stick with the Verlaine after practically going to sleep with quandariness, and for Mike I just stroll into the Park Lane liquor store and I ask for a bottle of Strega, and then I go back where I came from to Sixth Avenue and the tobacconist in the Ziegfeld Theater and casually ask for a carton of Gauloises and a carton of Picayunes and a New York Post with her face on it, and I am sweating a lot by now and thinking of leaning on the John door in the five spot while she whispered a song along the keyboard to Mel Waldron, and everyone and I stopped breathing.
Isn't that nature poetry?
Thank you, Stephen.
It's the nature I know.
Why would you say that? Do you think that's nature poetry?
Well, I have a pretty serious problem with the whole concept because I don't understand what isn't nature, what
Fantastic.
Would be unnatural. But maybe that's just because I'm from Brooklyn, you know, so concrete seems natural to me. I don't understand how people draw a distinction between us and nature. We obviously come out of nature, and what we do would seem to me to be, by definition, natural. So how can anything we are engaged with or anything we make, whether it's buildings or the city streets or the various arts referred to in that poem, how is that not nature? I would think that would be, in part, Mr. O'Hara's point.
I think you're right. I think that it does not only display nature as made things and received things as from a kind of bounty, but that it also in its form enacts a kind of naturalness. Wasn't that one of his arguments about making poetry, that he probably, like so many other poems, wrote that on his lunch hour, a kind of natural break in the day, and he wrote it and probably edited it very little, so that it in itself is a natural response to this very sad making death. How many people in this room with me are actually from cities? Stephen, you're from Brooklyn.
Oh yeah.
Gary.
It's much as Denver's a city. Yes.
I grew up in Charlotte.
So, okay, yeah. And I grew up in Washington, D.C., so...
Well, none of us are qualified.
None of us, that's right. My father grew up on a dairy farm in Wisconsin during the Depression and could not wait to get to the city. So there might be something lacking in nature for some of us, I'm not sure.
Well, but as you say, you now live essentially in the woods, and that's part of how you come to nature is through the lens of your city experience.
Absolutely. I'm often terrified of what's going on in the woods around me.
What part of it you're aware of.
Exactly. I know how to deal with a mugger, but I don't know how to deal with a bear.
Same thing.
Guns, one way or the other.
Why don't we look at an extreme version of what I think might be called a nature poem? And this is from the poet Mary Oliver, who seems to be a kind of whipping girl for nature poetry on occasion. And I very much respect her work and love the very aggressive drive towards imminence that she seems to be thinking about. And this poem seems to be a kind of reaction to the sentimentalizing vision that we might actually bring to her poems. And it's also just a very funny little lesson in poetry history. This is called A Lesson from James Wright. If James Wright could put in his book of poems a blank page dedicated to the horse David who ate one of my poems, I am ready to follow him along the sweet path he cut through the dryness and suggest that you sit now, very quietly, in some lovely wild place and listen to the silence. And I say that this too is a poem. Agreement? Disagreement? Is that a poem? I don't think we can hurt Mary Oliver's feelings if we argue with her. But maybe we agree with that?
Well, but now I'm really lost. You're asking if it's a poem.
Yeah, I know. That's why I thought that poem was very funny, because the notion that nature is a poem is so... I mean, I didn't smoke enough pot before I came here to start unraveling the downward spiral of that idea, that kind of self-reflexivity about the poem being nature, being natural, being a man-made thing, being nature, seems to not answer our question, but certainly point fingers at it.
Well, what's funny to me about that is that you introduce this great natural poet with a bookish poem.
Yes. yeah. Thank you for noticing that irony.
So I came armed with all sorts of poetry just in case it would be appropriate for a response. And
fantastic.
With thinking, you know, about nature, it was hard not to think a little bit about Wordsworth. So the tables turned. Up, my friend, and quit your books, or surely you'll grow double. Up, my friend, and clear your looks. Why all this toil and trouble? The sun above the mountain's head, a freshening luster, mellow through all the long green fields has spread, his first sweet evening yellow. Books, 'tis a dull and endless strife. Come, hear the woodland linnet, how sweet his music. On my life there's more of wisdom in it. And hark, how blithe the throstle sings. He too is no mean preacher. Come forth into the light of things. Let nature be your teacher. She has a world of ready wealth, our minds and hearts to bless. Spontaneous wisdom breathed by health, truth breathed by cheerfulness. One impulse from a vernal wood may teach you more of man, of moral evil and of good, than all the sages can. Sweet is the lore which nature brings. Our meddling intellect misshapes the beauteous forms of things we murder to dissect. Enough of science and of art. Close up those barren leaves. Come forth and bring with you a heart that watches and receives.
It's beautiful.
Good old Wordsworth.
Yeah, good old Wordsworth.
Yeah. Well, Emerson in The American Scholar, talking about reading, suggests that ideally one would read God directly, so he would similarly send you sort of out into the woods or whatever, and then books would be for, really when it gets dark. Right.
When it's raining and you can't go outside.
Exactly. Right, that, right. That's pretty much what he allows right. the purpose of books for. Yeah. So pre-electric light and things.
Right.
I
you
guess.
Have to have candles, of course, lots of candles or yeah. lanterns yeah. or something. Yeah.
But I mean, yeah. I also think that although to interrogate the distinction between nature and culture is right on, and I wonder about it as well. It's it is a persistent dialectic. And so I also wonder if we don't get something out of it. I mean, obviously Wordsworth is tackling it directly there and turning the tables. Is his whole his whole premise. So it seems to serve to have it as nature and culture as some sort of dialectic extant, even if one's going to point out the ways in which it's false. And I guess it seems to me that's something that's going on. It starts with the Romantics and then persists, and everyone seems to be, not everyone, many people seem to be interested in playing across it. And then we all, meeting for coffee this afternoon, discovered lots of poems where it's blurred, and maybe that's actually more the realm where it exists, and the sharp distinction between natural and unnatural is more of a more of a theoretical position.
Yeah. Even Wordsworth in Tintern Abbey talks about nature as being half discovered and half created. That it's something both seen, it's out there, discovered, to be discovered, but it's something that we also create in our imagination.
Well, I found another poem called "The World Is Too Much with Us," wherein he seems more or less to be saying, "Well, it's pretty clear that I'm not going to learn anything by looking at human beings," but he's not at all sure that he can learn anything from nature either. Mm-hmm. It's more or less a prayer that something be revealed. And that seems to me to be also the real issue, probably from the poet's point of view. Can you learn anything about what we are and where we are in any way whatsoever, even from what we call nature?
And I think that Wordsworth's project opens up, actually dramatically shifts some of the expectations of what one does with nature poetry to this notion of receiving something by the act of observing nature, that information is going to either help us or not, one does not know, but that the looking becomes less of an act of trying to civilize nature or humanize nature, to having nature come to us as a naturalizing force or a wilding force, something to make us less human and therefore more human, if that sort of makes sense. In other words, throughout the history of nature poetry, we see people, poets, civilizations trying to impose on nature humanity. We're going to go out into nature to feel good.
And the 18th century tradition that Wordsworth was really reacting to in his own work was very much a tradition of that, approach to nature, that vision of nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then even in a poem where he rhymes linnet with innit, which is actually a very kind of nice rhyme to put those two, it's very exact, but it also is witty because it takes two words to make innit. So it's not, it's not as direct as it might seem. He had to work to get there. that even in that, there is this cross-purposed civilizing beauty, and then this, the linnet flies when in it comes up, so that he is releasing nature through the rhyme, therefore, again, complicating the making of poetry with nature as a topic or a muse.
Right.
Let me read, because Jeff said the word locus. I thought it was a fantastic word. And of course, then, the Romantics are all about the genius loci and the spirit immanent in the world. I just wanted to read, as a kind of found poem, if you will, the categories of Czesław Miłosz's book, the anthology A Book of Luminous Things, because I think that the categories point out some of our expectations of what we might find in nature poetry. So these categories in A Book of Luminous Things: epiphany, nature, the secret of a thing, travel, places, the moment, people among people, woman's skin, situations. Yeah, it's a whole category.
I like that category.
What say you about that category?
That's my favorite.
Yes.
Non-attachment and history. So that I guess for me, thinking about this show this week and thinking about my crankiness about nature, poetry, I surrender. When I hear those categories and when I think about how much interesting poetry I read this week, too much to for an hour to contain, I'm really astounded. And so I surrender to the notion of it. Although, of course, I retain the right to, you know, be my natural self.
We'll be right back.
I think that those categories for me will just immediately explode the notion of what nature poetry is and can be. And it's interesting that he also starts with epiphany, because I think that's the shorthand. Nature poem equals epiphany. That if there's any resistance to it myself, then that would be it. That it's only thought of that way. Not wanting to take up 20 minutes of our show reading. Tintern Abbey, but that's
great, you know, though
this,
it is.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But of course, as we know, this is the model of the encounter with nature. What Abrams calls the greater romantic lyric, the outward looking, to the Abbey in this case, than the inward reflection, oftentimes into memory, but like coming out of that some sort of revelation or epiphany. And then the third move of the greater romantic lyric, where going back out to look at the other world or nature in this case to find it changed in some way. It's not a bad little structure, lacking one on a morning when you wanted to write a poem, you know, like, and if you, you know, and many fantastic and wonderful poems since Wordsworth, you know, have been written on that model. But I do think that there's a way in which that can become a kind of mannerism and a sort of certainty that by going to nature, epiphany or revelation will be had, and we'll come back in this fairly tidy structure. So, but you know, once you then think about that, and I think that epiphanies are satisfying in poetry, and you can start seeing other places where they can happen. But I was looking at Ellen Bryant Voigt in her book Shadow of Heaven, and really just a poem that knocks me out in general. But I think that she's using I think that she's using nature really as an analogy here, as a way of getting into another experience, but not directly apprehending it, really as the premise. So the poem's Winterfield. The Winterfield is not the field of summer lost in snow. It is another thing, a different thing. We shouted, we shook you tell me, but there was no sound, no face, no fear, only oblivion. Why shouldn't it be so? After they pierced a vein and fished me up, after they reeled me back, they packed me under, blanket on top of blanket, I trembled so. The summer field, sun-fed, mutable, has its many tasks. The winter field becomes its adjective. For those hours, I was some other thing, and my body, which you have long loved well, did not love you. There, to me, it's a structural move of the poem to just lay in these fields across something else, which is otherwise a personal lyric, and it's the analogy that she's making hopefully helps us read that personal experience differently. But one could almost imagine sort of two separate poems, one where she's talking about her personal experience, and this other one about the summer field and the winter field, more rhetorical in many ways.
What's also really beautiful about that poem is that she uses nature as a way to have an unsentimentalizing experience, or a kind of fierce experience. The ending of that poem is unexpected in its claim of unlove.
Yeah, because the field has no feelings.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And for a poet to use that natural, the experience of nature, or the natural occurrence of the landscape, to desentimentalize something, or to have the opposite experience of what is expected from the nature poem, is very canny and very smart, I have to say. It's a beautiful strategy. And it reminds me of her essay in the Flexible Lyric called Ruthless Attention. And so in that poem, we also see a ruthless attention paid to these experiences, and she does not present a human self until later in the poem through the pronoun I. There's we there,
yeah.
Which is, of course, perhaps human or perhaps not. We're not necessarily sure who the speaker is for a while, or I'm not anyway.
Absolutely.
And in that essay, she talks about the delaying of the self as a strategy of as a strategy for the poet to learn how to do that. The poet wants to start with the self,
yeah.
And that's not necessarily going to produce an excellent poem. and in that essay, thank you for bringing her up, Gary, because I was thinking about that essay this week. And she quotes Robert Haas, who I think we would call a nature poet of sorts. talking about Richard Wright and praising in James Wright and praising in James Wright's work the willing to be writing from personal experience rather than about personal experience, those prepositions being very important, that the mm-hmm. from is a situation and not necessarily a telling of the self. And this poem that you read, Gary, beautifully does contain a from in it.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there are other traditions that try to eliminate that altogether in the Chinese and Japanese traditions of deep, deep observation of nature. I brought two very brief pieces, both by Ezra Pound, one a translation, and then the other his version of that, in a way. The first is called Tsai Chi. The petals fall in the fountains, the orange-colored rose leaves, their ochre clings to the stone. Now that's a nature poem. And then there's Pound's own, In a Station of the Metro. The apparition of these faces in the crowd, petals on a wet black bough. So these kinds of poems seem to suggest that in a way we need to transcend ourselves and the human, eliminate them altogether in order to see the world as it is. So I also have a counter example for that in the works of my late friend William Bronk, who just kept having a really, really hard time finding what it is at all. These two are from a very unusual, rare collection called The Meantime, although it is in the collected poems as well. Where are we? The biological life is not the life of the universe. Is the large splendor of stars only to ornament or illuminate us? No. Their life is the main show. Our eyes and minds participate. Where abstract is concrete at last, our desire feels the stars. Watch. Be aware. Time is the distances of space. Look, look. It is all there. Now, that would seem to suggest that if we get out of ourselves, we'll see something, and maybe not.
Through the process of looking. Mm. That's such a strong directive at the end.
Mm-hmm. Very powerful. But ontology offers a hindrance to humanism.
Indeed.
If man is your proper study, do not look for him in the sciences of the natural world. He will evade you there, hiding behind his husk and effigy, staying unknown. Concomitantly, don't look at man for any reality. He is the husk himself in respect to that. We can never know what we want to know. That just sums it
never?
Up for me. That's it. All done now.
Shucks.
That's nature, buddy.
Yeah, the interesting thing about Brunk is that that attempt and even that a conclusion is just consistent through the entire life, which is what I love about him. Mm-hmm. It suggests to me that as certain as he is at the ends of some of those poems, there's not a certainty. Again, this interaction has to keep occurring. I guess I would continue to call it an attempt or versions of a looking to then quarrel with and come back to the notion. He doesn't wrap it up and then like sort of leave poetry behind it in that way.
Well, he can't because he's human, and you know you can't stop even if you would wish to. But he did come to a pretty firm conclusion, and it was kind of there from the beginning, which is why there's such great consistency across the body of work. But no matter where he looked, it was the unknowing and the unknowable that kept staring back at him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of reminds me of the Edmund Husserl's work. Do you know his Cartesian Meditations? Fabulous study of what it is to look at something, you know, what it is to try and actually see, and finally it's impossible in a sense, without going through a process of what he calls eidetic reduction, where you're just basically bracketing yourself in order to get closer and closer, if never there, you know, to the object.
I have to confess, I love this word, this notion, the eidetic, the re-experiencing of a situation through an image, mm-hmm. that the image remains vital and strong throughout the life, as if it's a continuing epiphany, mm-hmm. that the image is constantly available to you, is a kind of extraordinary idea. And I think it is something perhaps that poetry, some poetry, wants to do, mm-hmm. to continue to be alive as an image every single time. Mm-hmm. On the page in the poem, but that it's borrowing this genuine experience, mm-hmm. From the life.
Yeah. I mean, Pound certainly works with image. I mean, he's all about the eidos, I think. Yeah. And of course, you know, more recent practitioners, poets like Bly, who began as an image, definitely an image poet. Yeah. And Wright. James Wright.
And James Wright.
Of course.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And then a poet who I love is Merwin, another kind of fierce nature poet. And I think the other thing to mention about nature poetry is that there is a possibility of, because of this eidetic notion, because we can continually, if we're lucky, I think, or... perhaps tortured, be revisited by these informing images over and over throughout our lives, that there's a political possibility in that as well, that the fierce experience of nature and the fierce potential ownership of it as a steward seems to drive a lot of nature poets, mm-hmm. and so that we see people like Merwin setting, you know, in his quote-unquote real life, although Ed Hirsch once chastised me correctly for separating my poetry from my life, saying that he himself did not see a distinction between the two. I felt like,
it's, you only know, apparent
in your life or in his life?
Well, he thought, because in his life, also in my life, and I was upset that my rabbi was angry with me. that we see, you know, Merwin adapting a pineapple grove as a place to save plants that are going into extinction. We also see lots of poets, Merwin, Snyder, really writing also with an eye towards a very specific outcome for the earth, not knowing what to expect. We would like it to continue.
Yeah, to remain habitable. That would be good.
Right, habitable for something besides non-poetry writing cockroaches.
Right, right.
And so that we do see...
Was that an Archie Unhittable reference?
Oh, that was urban.
Some of the best writing by a cockroach I've ever seen.
Oh, you don't like The Metamorphosis?
Well, that too, but it's not a poem. Unless it's a prose poem.
I wanted to put Merwin into the room,
yes.
with us, and I wanted to read a poem from his newest book, The Shadow of Sirius. And I do think that there's a pun in that, Sirius. It's spelled S-I-R-I-U-S, and it apparently does not, I have not seen it in the poem, and there's a beautiful essay about this book by Helen Bendler in a recent New York Review of Books that does an admirable job of describing Merwin's work throughout his life. So if you're looking for some yummy criticism, it awaits you in the New York Review of Books.
Which is probably online. I mean, yeah, I don't know. They don't put all their articles online, but...
It might be.
It would be worth checking out.
Yeah. This is called Unknown Age. For all the features it hoards and displays, age seems to be without substance at any time. Whether morning or evening, it is a moment of air, held between the hands like a stunned bird. While I stand remembering light in the trees of another century on a continent long submerged, with no way of telling whether the leaves at that time felt memory as they were touching the day, and no knowledge of what happened to the reflections on the pond's surface that never were seen again. The bird lies still while the light goes on flying.
Nice Merwin.
I wondered if there was some, if this was a good, fairly ham-handed, actually, segue into reading some of our own poems that may or may not talk to this subject or argue with this subject.
Why don't we take a break and come back and do just that?
Fantastic.
Perfect.
You're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5, Asheville, North Carolina. I'm your host, Jeff Davis, or I'm actually the engineer today.
Right, I'm your host, Landon Godfrey.
I'm your host, Gary Hawkins.
And I'm not your host, Stephen Samuels.
Too many cooks.
Yeah, too many cooks. Too many poets in the room. Watch out. So in thinking about Merwin, I will also confess to claiming a great influence from him. I don't think actually you could see a lot of Merwin in a lot of my poems, but I have written a few poems that borrow directly from his structures, his punctuationless lineation, which then allows a kind of air-filled pressure to be put on the lines. It's really, it looks like it's ephemeral, and then all of a sudden it is really pounding on some meanings that wouldn't have been possible with punctuation. And I was very struck by one of his recent books, Odes. So I wrote an ode directly influenced by his version of that structure, and I'm going to read it to you now. to citrine. You flash bright green, bright shine, so even lying on the sidewalk next to a marble pillar, you seem alive. Before I can pick you up, a little boy lifts your body. His mother hums hummingbird. He hums hummingbird back into the mirror of her voice, the sad sound reflecting off their tongues and off your jewel belly, which nudges the sun like a hill in a miniature landscape painting, echoing, diminishing song, and off the tearless joy of eyes hearing your green fire.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, when Vendler talks about Merwin, I mean, she has a wonderful argument for the punctuationlessness. She doesn't use the word eminence, but that's essentially her argument, is that that's part of how he achieves that sort of nowness there, right? You know, and it's interesting that it seems fitting for the ode, which is all trying to collapse that distance between the you and the, in this case, do we call it a thing?
Dead hummingbird.
Yeah. So nice.
Yeah. Very nice.
Gary, would you like to read some poems?
Sure,
nature poems.
Well, in that, I've thinking about this dialogue between the speaker and the poem and the speaker and nature, as it were, or the human and nature. I pulled this poem, which is called "Crawl," which is in a series of couplets, dramatizing and sometimes maybe exaggerating that sort of dialogue. "Crawl." From his dry rock, he prays to the lake, "Part from me." The hard surface replies, "I'm open." His skin tells the waves, "Please, break." The waves answer back, "Do not fight." Arms lengthen a request, "Flow us straight." A far shore echoes, "Follow my voice." He commands himself, thin like a fish. Overhead, a circling falcon inquires, "Is it too big to lift?" His floating form replies, "What floats has died." He mumbles something with his blue lips. "Everything that sinks surely will rise."
Nice.
It's beautiful.
Nice?
It's not nice.
Just not quite the word I'd have selected.
Nature is not nice. So much.
No swearing allowed on the radio.
No. At least not the seven deadly words.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
My turn.
Yeah, your turn.
The last thing in the world I would think of myself as is a nature poet. So I will continue the argument with myself with two very short poems, one just a quatrain and the other, oh Lord, a sonnet. This one is so short there is no title. Your hand on the gate, shawl pulled close against the last of winter. I gave you nothing. That would be an urban poem.
Yeah, also not nice.
That was just me not being nice.
Yes.
Or rather, the world being very harsh to all of us. This is from a series of sonnets that I have excised from my canon, but I revived it for today because I found that in the fifth of the sixth, I seem to only be looking at the world. So this is the fifth of the marriage sonnets. The ragged surface of the ocean lies quiet. Vibrant blue gives way to muddy shades and crimson swaths reminiscent of blood. White caps and breakers reconvene. The storm builds slowly, suddenly bursts. Gales and heavy rains and the waters through the night. Nothing to be seen, only heard and conjectured. At dawn, when the rain has stopped and the sun appears, the sea is a bilious green. The wind does not abate, it blows more strongly. This storm has not brought destruction, but terrible disturbance. The swells continue, The turbulence persists. Is it days before subsiding? The sea calms gradually. The water is fogged in and uniformly gray. It's well past the season. The ocean is like ice.
Yeah, so you look only at the natural world, yet that title shimmers it in another direction. So it's like if we hadn't the marriage sonnets, we'd have a very different reading of a poem on which we're trying to like parse the sea through the idea that this is a marriage sonnet. Yeah.
Well, the reason I selected this one was I was kind of curious to see how much of the otherwise deeply personal comes through in spite of putting it all out on the objectified world.
Right. Or because of it.
Well, actually, the process of the poem is the speaker is driven to this place.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all I got on nature. Yeah.
Give us a Brooklyn poem.
I don't want to call you a liar in public.
That would be rude.
Now, Jeff, your most recent book is called Natures, so you may or may not be a priest in this room. I don't know. But I'm sure you've wrestled with this these quandaries.
I suppose I have, yes.
Yeah.
When I set about publishing Nature, Nature's gathering up the poems, I almost called it Naturu, which is the Egyptian term for the spirits in all things. We all, you know, all the little critters out there have Naturu. So, but I didn't. I wound up calling it Nature. So this is a poem that I wrote for Harry Callahan, who is a photographer. I actually spent much of my professional life as a photographer looking at things through machines. It's called Steps for Harry Callahan. You must be to what you'd know the nature of close and open. These leaves have turned stiff, warped dry in the white snow, still open, dead, and beyond they go, all one. And this is my attempt at an urban poem. This is
fantastic.
It's actually about a musical group, but it merges, fuses in a way natural with more urban imagery. The bridge, the syntax of a magnolia unravels in the dream. Each flower passes into a trajectory through forms. A long bridge leads from the earth through these limbs, all built by the eye of the sea, turned in the roots spiral from veil to veil, a bridge cast from the ash of the flower, grateful, dead, charred petals channel the air. As you see, I worked in the name of the band.
Very nice.
This was back in the 70s where they were not like known. You had to be at that time to get Grateful Dead records. You had to actually order them from the band because record stores did not carry them. So, but I was impressed by the way they built bridges between songs. They have these long, what we now call jams. Everybody does them, and so that was about their bridges.
Well, I guess we can see that we don't really have to choose, right? We can persist in not choosing.
Yeah,
it's an open field.
As it were. Often I return to a meadow, yes.
Yes.
One more.
Why don't we close with a poem selected by Miłosz for this anthology by a Polish poet named Zbigniew Maszew. Hmm. And, well, actually, that J isn't an F. Mashesh. Called Orchards in July. Waters from cold springs and glittering minerals tirelessly wander. Patient, unceasing, they overcome granite, layers of hungry gravel, iridescent precincts of clay. If they abandon themselves to the black roots, it's only to go up, as high as possible, through wells hidden under the bark of fruit trees, through the gray, green touched with gray of leaves, fallen petals of white flowers with rosy edges, apples heavy with sweet redness and their bitterish seeds. O waters from cold springs and glittering minerals, you are awaited by a cirrus with a fluid, sunny outline, and by an abyss of blue which has been rinsed in the just wind.
Nice. I don't know that work, but that's very interesting. Yeah. Thanks so much to all of you for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Let's continue the conversation.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great. And that's Wordplay for this Sunday. So tune in next Sunday for more poetry on the airwaves and in the ether.